Okay, good evening, everyone. Thank you all for your commitment and making sure to be here, even though I actually made the mistake. But now that it's recording, just so we could put it on the record, starting next week, officially, it should say in the bulletin, 8:30 Shir. That way, there's enough time for everyone to get back from Mincha and Maariv, make themselves, well, I guess not a coffee at this hour, I'd imagine, but get yourself ready for the Shir, B'Shava B'Nachas. Okay, so we are on Tes Amid Beis. We are on 9b, and you should easily be able to find where we are starting because it is the Mishnah, the first Mishnah on the page toward the top. And we're continuing our discussion about a Suma. Well, now we're going to talk about a Suma and a Sone. So we talked about Gullus. We talked about how you get sent into exile if you inadvertently kill someone. We actually had a fascinating discussion last time about current events and how can we extrapolate the principles we're learning now about inadvertent murder to what we're seeing in the news nowadays. We noted that we might be able to connect some things, but not all the factors in play are analogous. But it's something that you look at social media now. I've seen a bunch of rabbis with social media presences trying to connect Gemaras and Sanhedrin and Makos to what happened in the Chauvin case. I've seen a lot of inaccurate analogies, but we'll leave that for another time. Anyway, the Mishnah begins as follows. We're going to talk about someone who is blind, and in the second part of the Mishnah is going to talk about a sone, someone who has a vendetta against the victim, which we have discussed previously. Hasuma eno gola, according to the first opinion, the Mishnah of the Tanakhama says, someone who is blind, if they inadvertently kill someone, they don't even get sentenced to gullus. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. That's the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir Omer gola. Rabbi Meir says, no, a blind person has the same status as a non-blind person. And the person who is blind goes to exile the same way as anybody else. Now, what is the basis of their dispute? Is it just arbitrary? No, the Gemara will explain why they're disagreeing as usual. Next part of the Mishnah. So that's part number one. Part number two, we get a little bit more detail. We're actually going to have a three-way disputation here. So now we're going to talk about a sone. Sone literally means someone who has hatred, who bears hatred for the other person. Like sone Yisrael, haters of Israel. Has sone eno gola. Opinion number one of the Tanakhama, someone who is a sone. So I'm gonna not translate this term every time because we're gonna say it a million times. So just remember it now, write in your notes if you need it. A sone is someone who bears hate for the victim. Okay, that is what sone is. So ace, right? Clear? Good. Anything question on that before we move on? Okay, that'll make the rest of the class easier now. Has sone eno gola. A sone does not get sent into gullus when he kills somebody. Rabbi Yossi Omer, has sone neharag neshahu kamuan. Actually, not only does he not go to gullus, but in fact, because we know that he bears hatred for the victim, we assume he's kamuan. Tell me, what's a muad? You look above a comma, it talks about a shor hamuad. So a shor hamuad is an ox that's gored three times already. When it gores the fourth time, the owner can't say, oh, how was I supposed to know? Poor Bessie, she's such a kind cow. She never hurt a fly. Well, she already gored three times. So it becomes a muad. She becomes designated as it, well, I guess cows don't have the horns. It's the male ones. Ox has the horns. And it's designated as a killer. So this is like the principle almost of adam muad la'olam. So this person over here, a sone especially, not just a regular adam, a sone, someone who has it out for him, he gets sent, he doesn't get sent to Gullus, but he gets a death penalty. Rabbi Shimon Omer, the third and final opinion is, sometimes yes, sometimes no. Yesh sone gola, v'yesh sone she'eno gola. There is a sone, there's a type of sone who does go into exile, and there's certain sonen that do not go into exile. How do we distinguish? Zehaklal, kol shu yochel omer ledas harag. We actually look at the circumstances. So this is good for the lawyers over here that I know you've, I think a number of you have brought up circumstantial evidence. How do we assess the circumstances here? So this opinion actually takes the circumstances into account. If the circumstances lead us to believe that he deliberately killed someone, even if it maybe looks like an accident, he was clearly doing it as a cover-up. Therefore, he gets put to death. But if it looks like even the Sone made a mistake over here, he slipped up, then he goes to Gullus because we know it was done inadvertently. Now, what kind of circumstances lend themselves to making us think it was deliberate? What kind do we know is a genuine mistake? The Gemara will discuss that as well. So let me just pause over here for a moment just for clarification questions. Does anyone have any clarification questions on this Mishnah before we go forward? Okay. Oh, yes, Judd.
I mean, the last statement is really what adjudication is. What is the purpose of the last statement? It says, and the opposite. I mean, that's what has to be determined. It's
right. So Judd is asking, and you'll tell me if I got the question right. What Judd's asking is, that's always the criteria that we deal with. Even if the guy's not a Sone, we always ask, does it look like it was deliberate? Does it look like it was accidental? So why is a Sone any different, right? Is that the question? So the Gemara will explain. Yeah, Henry?
No, actually, it's more of a question on the first two opinions, why they would, even though there is a Sone, why would they assume one way or the other without us judge saying, finding out what really happened, right? It's like they're not, if you want to use an American term, they're not giving the guy due process here.
Right. Well, I think all of these, even according to first two opinions, they would still need to assess the circumstances. But I think, right, the first two opinions, you're saying they assume that if this guy has a history of hatred and, just bad blood with this person, we assume if he kills him, it's not accidental. And we assume that even if it looked accidental, it was clearly a cover-up as an excuse. It would seem
when
that...
When you use the term assume, you mean presumption, right? Presume.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's rebuttable. You see, so you just start out with a presumption, like the way we have a presumption of innocence, but it's rebuttable as the facts develop.
Right. So I think, the point you're making is what Henry's pointing out, which is it sounds like in the first two opinions, there is a presumption. There is no presumption of innocence even. It sounds like just by default, we assume. Now, even according to the first opinions, maybe in some extreme circumstances where we know it wasn't his fault, maybe they let him off the hook. But it sounds like the third opinion of Mishnah, which is of Rabbi Shimon, he says that he has a lower bar for letting the Sone off the hook. The first two opinions will have a much higher bar for that. And the Gemara will actually give us a case. I know we're talking in very abstract terms, right? What's that mean, a high bar? So the Gemara will actually give us a case of where a Sone gets sent into Gullus because we assume he did deliberately, whereas a regular Joe on the street would not get sent into Gullus for doing the exact same act. So when we get to that Gemara, you'll let me know if that addresses the question. But these are really good points that you're all raising. Yes, sir.
So, Rabbi, before you move on, though, I think Toby said something that's really interesting because, Toby, you're actually saying that, or what I take from what you said is that essentially when you have a Sone, it changes the standard from perhaps a neutral position to a presumption of guilt. And maybe it's a rebuttable presumption. And so I guess the Gemara will bear this out, whether this is correct or not. But when we were looking at the earlier cases where someone swings the axe in the woods and the head falls off and hits the guy and kills him, or the one on the ladder and the up and the down or whatever, there's a neutral presumption and it's just based on the facts. And here you get to a place where you got a Sone who there's a presumption of like a malice aforethought, and maybe that's rebuttable, maybe it's not, we'll see, but that's the difference. And so that's the significance of this whole discussion about a Sone. Is that, Rabbi, are we on the right track? Are we going to?
I think you are. And I'll add in the halachic terminology, which is what you're actually mentioning. we assume that every person has what's called a cheskas kashrus, which I think is what you described in the legal terminology, which is a presumption of innocence, a presumption of not bearing ill intent. The sone seems to not have a cheskas kashrus. He doesn't have literally a presumption of kashrus, of being kosher, of doing everything the right way. You know, most people, we assume that if they, we're down the kaf's chus, they have a cheskas kashrus. But there are certain people that if they are involved in illicit activities, or, you know, in our particular case, they bear ill will towards another person, then they don't come in with presumption of good, neutral intent. So I think
But it doesn't push it far enough to execute him, right?
Well, actually,
because there's still the circumstances that he didn't stand there and say, I'm going to kill you, wham. It still looked like an accident. You're still within, right? I mean, because otherwise, why aren't they just executing him?
That's the first opinion. The first opinion is he doesn't go to Gullus, but remember we talked about, you know, if he doesn't go to Gullus, the relatives can still come after him, and just the Ari Miklat will not protect him. But the second opinion, Rabbi Yossi, he says, Hasone Neharai. He's put to death by the court. He's actually executed. And the Gemara will explain, wait a minute, don't we need all these conditions of giving him Hasra and warning him? We actually addressed this case earlier. So if we don't remember the answer on the spot, don't worry, the Gemara is going to remind us. So all great points being raised, and I think it will think more deeply about it as we go through the Gemara, God willing. So before we jump in, it sounds like the second part of the Mishnah is what's grabbing our attention more, which makes sense. But first, we need to give a little bit of elucidation to the first part of the Mishnah. No one asked, what gives? Why are we treating a person as blind different than any other person, right? Where's the equity in that? We've seen a lot of that recently.
It's not an equity issue, though. It's the lower oath. It's just from the pasuk.
So Henry quotes the pasuk. Let's go into the Gemara that Henry's quoting. Tanur Rabbanan, we learned in the Braisa, below ra'os prat l'suma. So if you look, the pasuk that he's quoting from the Parsha of Gullus, so it says, O b'chol evan asher yamus ba below ra'os. So since it says without seeing, well, it below ra'os, it didn't have to put in those extra words. It's the exclusion of someone who does not have any sight. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda, that's the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda in our Mishnah. Rabbi Meir Omer, below ra'os, l'rabos is a summa. The word below ra'os, not only does it not exclude a summa, but it actually includes a person who is blind. Now, where does he get that from below ra'os? If anything, it says a lack of sight. That's excluding someone who doesn't have sight. So we explain both opinions. My time with Rabbi Yehuda, dechsib, asher yavo sereo bayar, afiu summa, Asa below afilu suma asa below ra'os ma'ate. So originally the pasuk of Asher Yavos Rea Bayar taught me even a suma, but asa below ra'os ma'ate. Then came along the pasuk of lo ra'os to exclude a suma. So I would think the pasuk that describes they went into a forest together, it could be anybody. We don't care if he could see or not. But then the words below ra'os exclude someone who cannot see. That part is very straightforward, I believe. The second part, Rabbi Meir, teaches us an important principle in rabbinic hermeneutics, right? Who says Rabbi Shmuel in the morning, right? We have Rabbi Shmuel. Even during COVID, we're saying Rabbi Shmuel. So it's important to pay attention to Rabbi Shmuel, because if you look at it, it's very different than the rest of davening. Other, you know, it's not Tehillim. It's actually halachic principles that we just casually say at the beginning, so we get in a rabbi's kaddish. Rabbi Meir below ra'os lema'et bivli das lema'et. So Rabbi Meir quotes one verse that says, "What you cannot see," that's one exclusion. And then also the Torah says, "Bivli das," is someone kills without knowledge, without intent. So what we have is habi miut achar miut. When we have one exclusion followed by a second exclusion, there's a principle in hermeneutics, the ein miut achar miut ela l'rabos, an exclusion that follows an exclusion, think of it as like a double negative, comes, the negatives cancel each other out, and it comes to include something. So therefore, since lo ra'os is followed by another exclusion of bivli das, without knowledge, actually what it does in the end is it doesn't exclude a summa, but rather it includes the blind person in there as well. So Baruch Hashem, the blind person is included as well, and they too will get punished if they kill someone inadvertently. So there's equality right there. Okay. Henry, you look like you wanted to say something, or...
No, the only thing is, obviously, based on the pasuk, but they're not trying to make, at least explicitly, a qualitative judgment on whether the blind person should be treated differently or not because they're blind. It's
just like the Zeris HaKasav, like you said earlier.
Right.
It's really, this is a case, there's no logic per se, or, you know, obviously, on a Shabbos morning sermon, we could come up with Tamei Dekra, and we could come up with the reasoning and the ethics and the message behind it. But ultimately what we're doing here is just plain power of hermeneutics over here. Not necessarily inserting any form of svara of human logic into the equation. But just let's just finish the Shaka Vitaria, finish this part of the Gemara. Rabbi Yehuda Bevli Das. So Rabbi Yehuda doesn't say miyad acher miyad. He doesn't say we have an exclusion after exclusion. So he must be using the term Bevli Das without knowledge for another hermeneutical purpose. For what? Prat the miskaven hu da'asa. So the extra words of Bivli Das, without knowledge, comes to tell us something we talked about earlier, that if someone kills without kavana, I thought that this what that person over there was an animal, right? Didn't it happen? I think it was was it Dick Cheney? He was going hunting and he thought it was an animal, and then he wound up shooting an actual person. I think it was him. I'm sure it's happened to many people in history. I just remember that one in particular, or that's how Cain got killed. So so you thought it was an animal, but it turned out to be a human. If you kill him, you go into gullus. So that's what he uses the extra word for. And that's how we have an argument regarding a summa. So that brings the end of the summa. And the next part of the Gemara, let's just jump right into it, is now going to address everyone's, the popular part of the Mishnah, apparently the popular part, which talks about our good friend, the Sone. Our good friend, the Sone. Rabbi Yossi Omer Hasone Narag Bechule. So here we go. The question that I forgot, one of you, I think, actually alluded to. Vahalo Asurbe. I think, Tom, maybe you were alluding to this. Wait a minute. How can we put this guy to death? We didn't even give him Hasra. We didn't warn him. Right? Was that what you were getting to?
Right? No. Okay.
Well, you helped us along over there. You know, inadvertently, Bishoge, you helped us along. So the question is, wait a minute, how are we putting this guy to death just because we think he had ill intent? Doesn't someone there need to be able to give him hasra to warn him, hey, buddy, you're not allowed to kill, otherwise base is going to put you to death? Remember, that was a prerequisite to putting somebody to death or to giving corporal punishment in the Torah. So how can Rabbi Yossi in the Mishnah, the second opinion, say a sone who accidentally kills someone, we assume it wasn't an, you know, it was an accident, you know, like the mafia talks. Yeah, you know, don't be surprised if that falls on top of you the next day. There'll be an accident. You know, it's not actually an accident. It reminds me, I still need to watch, need to go through the Godfather trilogy. So I only got through number one. So Masnisan Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehudahi. So it's actually our Mishnah is in accordance with our old friend Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda, who we've learned about previously. So just to refresh our memories, we quote the Brisa again, the Tanya. Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, the son of Yehuda, it's a different Rabbi Yossi, Omer, Chaver Eino Tzarech Hasra, an educated person who knows halacha and knows the consequences of their action, does not require warning. He does not need to be warned in order to put him to death for committing a murder. Why? Well, you have to ask yourself, what's the purpose of Hasra? I don't want to get us too far afield, but so, you know, you think about in Hilchos Nida. So on a, this is going to take us a little far afield, but I'll try to share it briefly. So on a biblical level, for a woman to be considered a Nida, to be considered impure due to menstruation, needs to be two things. It needs to be a Re'iyas Dam and a Hargosha. It needs to be a seeing actual blood, menstrual blood, and be a Hargosha, a feeling of that sensation. The issue is, most women today say that they do not feel a Hargosha. They don't feel any particular feeling. And this isn't just like a modern day phenomenon. This is already in the sources as well. So the question is, you know, is a woman even a Nida on a Doraisa level today? Is there such a thing as a woman being a biblical level Nida? So the question is the Hargasha, is it a Simen or is it a Siba? Meaning, is Hargasha an integral part of the definition of becoming a Nida? If you don't have that sensation of menstruation, then you don't become a Nida. Or is Hargasha a Simen? It's an indicator that one is now a Nida. So if one gets a certain sensation when having their period, which women back in the times of the Talmud apparently claimed that they had, then it's an indication, it's a simen that I am a Nida right now. But if I know it's my period and I don't have a sensation, it doesn't matter. I'm still a Nida. It's not a prerequisite to becoming a Nida. So it's a very similar chakira, dichotomy in halacha, which we call simen and siba, an indicator versus the actual cause, which applies here as well. Is the Hasra a Simen or is it a Siba? Does the Hasra, is it an integral part of turning someone into a murderer who could get capital punishment? Or is the Hasra just a means for us to know that this guy is aware of what he's doing before he commits the murder? But it's dispensable. If, in other words, if we know that this person is a Chaver, he knows Halacha, he knows full well that when he commits murder, Beis Din will put him to death, then Rabbi Yossi says, it's a simen, you know, just like I don't need the Hargasha. It just helps me identify this as Nida blood. I don't need Hasra. It just helps us identify this person as knowing what he's doing. So Rabbi Yossi says that the Hasra is dispensable because what's the purpose of Hasra? The Vishalo Nitna Hasra El Hafamid Shogil Amazin. We use Hasra to make sure the guy knows what he's doing, to make sure that we know that he's doing it on purpose. So here we're dealing with a sone. The Mefarshim point out, presumably a sone who also knows the halacha that he'll be put to death by Beis Din. You don't need to be the biggest scholar out there to know that if you murder someone, you likely get capital punishment for it. That's not a surprise to many. So since we know he has it out for this guy, we don't need to give him hasra because we know he deliberately wants to kill him. And therefore, Rav Yossi says this person is put to death even absent Hasra. And that brings us to the, that does not bring us to the end of the Mishnah yet. So let me pause briefly. I'll take only clarification questions, and then we'll pause right before the Mishnah to take any additional questions. Anything unclear I can clarify just on that section. Okay. And if you didn't get the Nida part, that's okay as well. I just thought that idea might help bring it out. Okay. Raishun Omer Yesh Sone Golem. This part is a little bit complicated because it seems that our text in the Gemara actually got switched around, and I'll show you what I mean. So remember Rabbi Shimon, he was the last to pay in the Mishnah. He says sometimes a sone goes to Gullus, sometimes he does not. Meaning sometimes it's deliberate, sometimes we assume it was accidental. Okay, how do we figure that out? Tanya, Ketzad, I'm already showing you sone gola, sone she'eno gola. So what is the case where Rabbi Shimon distinguishes? So very subtle detail. Let's say I'm pulling up a rope and it has like a heavy weight at the end, has a very heavy cast iron bucket, let's say. I don't know if anyone uses cast iron bucket. I'm trying to think of something that's heavy. Mm-hmm. So nifsak gola, if the rope snaps, then we assume it was an accident because it's very hard to orchestrate that the rope's just going to snap on its own just at the right moment when the guy passes under it. But nishmat eno gola, if he lost his grip on the rope and then the bucket falls down just at the right moment, happens to kill just the guy that he would love to be dead, is that really an accident? Oh, whoops, it just slipped out of my hand just at the right time to hit that guy I really hated and wanted to kill, you know, just at the right moment. That's harder to say is an accident. So if the rope snaps, that is more likely to be accidental. But if it's a nishma, if it slips out, for someone who's a sone, who we know had it out for that guy, we assume, you know, he wants his makom back in shul. He's been fighting with that guy for that seat. He's like, ah, perfect. Now there's going to be a vacancy. So that is what he says. We have a question. But wait a minute. We have a question. Rabbi Shimon contradicts himself. In another braisa, Rabbi Shimon says one only goes into exile in a case where the rope slips, well, not a rope here, it's not about an implement of sorts, a tool, but same principle, when it slips out of his hands, he goes to Gullus. So, kasha nifsaka nisa, kasha nishmana nishman. What we have here is a contradiction, because the implication of this other braisa is that in a case of nifsak, of it snapping, you don't go to Gullus, and in a case of nishman, of it slipping out, you do go to Gullus, which is diametrically opposed to what he said in the first teaching. He literally just contradicted himself right here. So what's the resolution? It's what you can imagine. The first braisa is talking about a sone. The second braisa is talking about a regular person who doesn't really care for a shimon walking by. For a regular person, if it slips out of my hands, like, why would I want to kill him? We assume that's an accident. So the text of the Gemara, by the way, gets switched around, and I'm going to read the alternate text. You're looking at Gosa Bach, you look at Rashi. I'm sure you can have a lot of fun if you're into manuscripts. So we're actually going to read it as Nishmat Anishmat Lokasha Ba'ohev Ha'besone. So the distinction in Rabbi Shimon between it slipping out is not problematic, because when it slips out, and we assume it was deliberate, that's the case of a sone. When it slips out of his hands, and we assume it was an accident, was the case of an ohev. He accidentally killed his friend. We assume that when it slips out, it was a genuine accident. Because again, he has a presumption of innocence. He's a cheskas kashrus. And similarly, nishmana nishmat lo kasha. Nifsak and nifsak lo kasha. We resolve the contradiction of when the rope snaps. Ha rebi v'ha rabbanan. One Bryce he was teaching according to Rebbe, one according to Rabbanan. What's this dispute between Rebbe and Rabbanan we speak of? If we remember a few weeks ago, we had the argument about what's the prototypical case in the Torah of someone swinging an axe and accidentally killing someone. Rebbe said the case is where he hacked at the tree, a splinter shoots out and kills somebody. The case according to Rabbanan was I swung from the axe and the axe head was nifsak, it dislodged from the hilt of the axe and killed somebody. So in the case of Nifsak, it's a machlokus, a dispute between Rebbe and the Rabbanan. The Rabbanan say, in case of Nifsak, when the axe head comes off or the rope snaps, it's the same case in principle, that is a case that sends you to Gullus. Rebbe says that's not a case that sends you to Gullus. That is too close. That's considered your direct strength, your koach, a force directly done by you. And actually, it's so close to murder that you don't even get to go to Gullus. You're not protected by the ir miklat. So that's that piece of Gemara over there. And that's probably the most confusing piece of the Gemara for the night. The rest of it is rather straightforward, actually. So I'll just pause here. We are actually limited on time, which again is my own fault. But if there are any essential questions, please share them. I know I set the bar really high. You're like, oh, do I have an essential question? I mean, if anyone has like a question to like help enhance the learning that we're doing now, you know, not about the Godfather. Okay, so hopefully that's clear. And what we're going to do now actually is, remember until this point, we've been talking about if you do this, you get sent into exile. You do that, you don't go to exile. So we never really fleshed out, you know, what are the Ari Mikla? What happens when you go into exile? You go to one of the cities of refuge. The cities of refuge were given out to the Levites, the Levium, as their cities. And there were six cities, six main cities, three in Aver LeYarden, across the Jordan, and three in the land of Israel. But why am I telling this to you? The Mishnah actually spells it out really clearly. So let's go right into it. So where does a person go when they go into exile? Leheichan Golan, the Mishnah asks. I already shared these details. We learned this together outside already. But the Mishnah hasn't really told us what happens when you go into exile. So it asks, where do you go? La'arei Miklat, you go to one of the cities of refuge. L'shal Shav Eber Yarden, L'shal Shav Eretz Kanan. There are three across the Jordan to the east. And there are three in Canaan, in Eretz Yisrael. Shenemar, it says in the verse, pretty explicit. However, until Yehoshua, until Joshua is able to establish the three are a miklat in Israel, lo hayu shoshim regarding kultos. The three in the across the Jordan did not operate. They weren't able to protect anyone until all of them were fully operational. Shemar, Shesh Ari Miklat Tiyena, you should have six cities of refuge. Achiu Shoshdon Kotos Ka'achas. Until all six are ready, none of them operate. So even though Moshe Rabbeinu established three Ari Miklat when he was still alive on the other side of the Jordan, it was only until Yehoshua came along and established three in Israel, that's when they all began to operate. Okay. The Mishnah now shares a few more details that gives us a little bit more texture to understand the Ari Miklat. Also, it's not enough just to have cities, but you actually have to have directions. There have to be clear paths leading from major cities to nearby Ari Miklat, cities of refuge. You know what it reminds me of? I remember when I was in Israel, so like certain places in Jerusalem, you'll go and there's like a sign saying Tel Aviv that way. I'm just like, what? Is Tel Aviv right around the corner? But it's like, oh no, you have to get on the highway and then you're in Tel Aviv. You know, it's like there's a sign, oh, New Haven's right over there. So, but that's basically what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to have signs in every city saying Ari Miklat that way to the Ari Miklat. Or, you know, when there's like hurricane escape route. I still don't understand what a hurricane escape route is, but I see signs for that all the time around town. I'm not really sure how that works in time of a hurricane, but anyway, that's the idea for Ari Miklat. There should be clear directions to getting there. And now this is a very interesting halacha that I hope to elaborate on at the end of this year, is that he has given two Torah scholars to escort him to the Ir Miklat. The Yedabru Elav, and that way, in case the Goelei Hadam, the relatives of the victim, want to avenge his blood, they'll say, oh, it's a perfect opportunity. He's not yet in the walls of the Ir Miklat. We're going to swoop down and kill him before he gets in the walls. You know, you can imagine, it's like a movie chase scene. Jeremy would appreciate, like in Lord of the Rings, when the Nazgul are chasing, and they get into the city sanctum. So you can imagine there's like a high chase scene going on, and they're on their tail, and they're about to get into the walls. Well, it doesn't always work out like in the movies. So they gave him two Torah scholars to hopefully, you know, persuade the guy and say, oh, look, you know, this guy, he's a nice person. He didn't really mean it. Would you really kill him in front of two Torah scholars? You know, so that's the idea. Now, why don't we give him two soldiers? I'll just share with you the idea right now. Take it or leave it. Right. You're saying like, what do you mean two rabbis? Like, imagine like one of you guys had to go into Gullis and then they give you me and Rabbi Cohen. I don't know, maybe Rabbi Cohen could fight well. I'm not trained in martial arts. So, you know, Rabbi Cohen will come with his golf stick and I'll just come with, you know, my grandfather's rifle. That's the best we could do. As opposed to giving them Carmine and maybe Chris, you know, as bodyguard. I'm trying to think who are like...
Yeah, I'll take them.
Ari Goldstein and David Dismore, you know, are CSS people. So would you rather CSS people to protect you or would you rather the clergy staff? I'd rather the CSS people than myself. So why are we giving them Torah scholars? That's the question. So it said, and it's Sotzei Ashas, I think it quotes Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. So it's the right Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. It might be referring to Rav Soloveitchik's father, but it might be a different one. So Rav Moshe Soloveitchik says, because it's a philosophy of how we deal with conflict. If we give the guy two bodyguards, the Goalei Hadam will come with four men. If we give him four men as bodyguards, the Goalei Hadam will come with eight. And eventually, they'll just create an entire milchama, the entire war. So rather than solve it with brute force, why don't we solve things and calm things down with diplomacy instead? It's a nice idea. I have my reservations because if diplomacy fails, what? They're all going to get shot now? So I don't have a good answer to that. But it's more like Shabbos morning sermon Torah than it is a practical answer. But I thought everyone would have that question when we read that line, so I just wanted to preempt it. Okay, but the Torah scholars speak. They try to persuade the guy not to kill the accidental murderer. Rabbi Meir Omer, Afu Medavar Adi Atzma, Shemar V'zed Dvar HaRetzeach. The accidental murderer, he could speak as well to advocate for himself. Interesting dispute here. Almost practical suggestions. Is it better for a defendant to be passive? It's almost like, Is the defendant be passive and let his lawyer do all the talking for him? Or is it a good idea sometimes for the defendant himself to speak up? Again, this was also something in the news recently to think about. And I'm sure our lawyers here have opinions on that. So Rabbi Yossi Bar Yehuda Omer, B'tchila Echad Shogiv Echad Mason Magdim Lari Miklat. This is something that many of you have raised. I'm glad we're addressing it now. We finally got to the Mishnah. The question is, okay, I accidentally killed somebody. Walk me through it. What are the next steps? What happens right at that moment? So initially, we bring you actually, you flee straight to the Ir Miklat. You flee straight there. It's almost like you're being held without bail. That's the idea. You're in Ir Miklat, while we don't know. Ubeist in Sholchem Avinu Somi Sham, and then Beist in summons him to court, and they go through the court proceedings. Misha is Chayav Misa Beist in Argu. So anyone who's Chayav Misa Beist in Argu, the Beist in kills him. Ushalon is Chayav Misa if he's found to be innocent, Patru. Okay, have a nice life, enjoy. And Misha is Chayav Gola, someone who actually indeed does belong in the Ir Miklat. He did inadvertently kill somebody, is liable for that. Machzir Solim Komo, we send him back to the Ir Miklat. Shemar, the Shivoso Idel Ir Miklato, he gets returned to the Ir Miklat. And that Mishnah gives us, I think, some more flavor and texture to understand what the cities of refuge are. And I think it addresses a few of the questions some of you have asked, rightfully so, at earlier stages, trying to understand what the Ir Miklat process looks like. So we're going to jump right into the Gemara. And the Gemara is going to continue to give us some more flavor and understand what the Ir Miklat look like.
I think when he gets summoned to the Beis Din, he gets escorted by Torah scholars, doesn't he?
Yes, I think so. I think each time he travels, he has an escort of two Torah scholars. That's my understanding. I know it doesn't explicate that. So what I wanted to do, I realized because I jumped on realizing that I was late, and I didn't have time to prepare it, but I'll try to send out an email, or you can Google search it yourself. You type in, I typed in Hebrew, but maybe if you type in English, it'll come up as well, the Sheish Ari Miklat. And it'll actually show you a diagram of where all the cities are. So I'll try to send an email out with a graphic to be helpful. But so what the Gemara is about to describe is that there are three cities in Israel, three cities outside of Israel. And if anyone finds the link and wants to share it in the chat, you're more than welcome to do so. So moving on, the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, Shalosh Arim Hivdil Moshe Be'er Yarden U'Knevan Hivdil Yosho Be'eretz Kanan. V'chamnos Hayu Kamin Shtei Shuro Shebekarim. Their formation was like two rows in a vineyard. Chevron B'Yehuda. So Chevron B'Yehuda Keneged Batzar B'Midbar. So Chevron, which was the southernmost main Ir Miklat in Israel, was, I don't know what you say, like Keneged, it was adjacent, not adjacent, what's the right word for it? It would have been
partnered with.
What was that?
Isn't it like you were partnered
to look across
like sister cities?
Right. So if you were like to look across the Jordan, it would be in the same place, around the same place in terms of its latitude, if that helps.
Yes. Yeah.
So Shechem Bahar Ephraim, Shechem, which was in Har Ephraim in Israel, Keneged Ramos Begilad. Same idea. Shechem, you can look across, you see the Ir Miklat somewhere, you know, like in Israel, when you go on a tour and say, on a clear day, you could see Tel Aviv all the way from here. You know, they tell you stuff like that. So on like a clear day, you can see the Ir Miklat all the way across the Jordan. Forgive my poor Israeli accent. Kadesh Bahar Naftali, Keneged Golan Bebashan. Same idea. Kadesh, which was all the way up in the north, you can then see the city of Golan, which was in Bashan. So that's how they were lined up. Mishilashta, and remember, we taught in the verse, it says Mishilashta. Ah, okay, there's a nice map in the Art Scroll of Chumash. So Yasher Koach, Henry. So if you have a Chumash in your house or next time you come to Shul, you got the good old Art Scroll stone Chumashim, and it has it in there. So Vishilashka, Shem Vishilashka, Shem Midarm Lechevron, Kimi Chevron Lechem, Kimi Chevron Lechem, Kimi Shechem Lekadesh, Kimi Shechem Lekadesh, Kimi Kadesh Etzafam. So the idea is that there's three cities for all of Israel. So it's the same, roughly the same amount of distance from the south of Israel to Hebron, from Hebron to Shechem, from Shechem to Kadesh, and from Kadesh all the way to the northern part of Israel. That way, you don't need to travel a significant amount of distance to find yourself in Ir Miklat. We tried to spread them out relatively equally. However, the Gemara asked, something seems a little bit non-equitable here. Be'er HaYarden class, Eretz Yisrael class? So what you're telling me, that Be'er HaYarden, that across the Jordan, they had just as many cities, Ir Miklat, as in Israel? But remember, in Israel, that's where the majority of the Jewish tribes exist. So Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet and Menashe, so you got 2.5 tribes on one side, and you have the rest of the tribes on the other side in Israel. You know, maybe give one city to the people across the Jordan and give the rest of the cities to the rest of the Jewish people who primarily reside in Israel. This doesn't make sense. So Amar Abaye, why was it made this way? Gilad Shechichi Rotzken, because in Gilad it was very common to have murderers, and therefore there was a huge need to have a number of cities there to accommodate all of the murderers who were living in that area. The Siv, Gilad Kiryas Kol Aven Akuva Midam. Maya Akuva Midam. What's it mean? Akuva Midam. It says in the verse, Amar Elazar Shayu Ukvin Laharog Nefashos. They lied in wait to ambush people on the path to kill them. So because there were so many murders that went on, they needed Ir Miklat. A number of the Mefarshim asked, wait a minute, if these are deliberate murderers, an Ir Miklat's not going to be helpful. Well, the issue is these people were actually, they played around. They realized that if they made their murders look accidental, you know, it was, you know, an accident's going to take place. So if they make it look like an accident, then they realize they'll get let off the hook. So there was a need for Ir Miklat, ironically. We're just going to finish up the. We're just going to go a little bit further in the Gemara, get to the end, and I'll take any remaining questions. I just want to make sure we get to what we need to get to. Umayshna mehay gisa umayhay gisa demekarke umayshna mitziyah demekarve. So, if you think about it, if you look at the map that Henry pointed out, or when you get a chance, if I am, you know, somewhere in middle of Israel, I only have to go, you know, if I'm between, let's say, Shechem and Hebron, the most I have to travel is halfway to Shechem or halfway to Hebron. But if I find myself all the way in the south or all the way in the north, I need to travel double the amount to either get to Kadesh or to get to Hebron. So that's not fair. What about the people who are living in those Yishuvim who are settling the northern part of Israel, defending us from Syria? And what about the people who are all the way in the south, defending us from vacationers in Eilat? So what about them? You know, they have to go to Gullis. They have to go so much further. That's not fair. So why were there so many cities concentrated more toward the middle of Israel? Same idea. Because in Shechem, I guess the more urban area of Israel, there was a lot of murders that were taking place. That there was all these people, these gangs of people who, these groups of Kohanim who were ready to kill. What does it mean, a group of Kohanim? What, you had a group of priests? I imagine, like, well, you had a group of, like, yeshiva bacharim who were sitting, lying in wait to pounce and kill people. I mean, if you see videos coming out of the Panovich Yeshiva in Israel, they actually could be trained for that. There was, there's a video in the news showing there's two factions in the Panovich Yeshiva now for which rabbi should be in charge. This is a fight that broke out. Shtenders were flying, their beatings. They were using what's it called, pepper spray at each other. Really crazy things you can see on the internet. So, but it's not what's talking about over here. It's not talking about a bunch of yeshiva bachim or about priests, but rather my chaver kohanim or lezer shall be mischaven laharu lefashut kohanim halo to mischaven lachlo chumus the base hagronos. That the same way kohanim would be gathering and flocking in the masses. To you know, like you go, imagine you go to a kiddush. Remember, right? So we have kiddushes again at shul. You're all welcome to come and join us. And they're only getting better and better. So from what I understand, at least in my own previous experience at kiddushes, you know, everyone's flocking around. You're elbowing the guy next to you to get a little bit of the challah before that guy sticks their hand into the kugel. So imagine like the way the kohanim were fighting each other to get a little piece of truma or to fight over the kiddush. That's how these murderers were, that they were all in these gangs hustling and bustling, trying to murder people. And therefore, there was a need for many Ir Miklat because of the many murders that took place. One last piece of Gemara, the Suleika. Wait a minute. You're telling me there's only six cities of Ari Miklat? Baksiv. It says in the Pasuk there should be 42 cities. Amar Abaye. Halo Kolos being the Das Mishlodas. The six original cities of refuge protected you, whether you were aware you were in it, whether you weren't. Meaning, let's say you were asleep and the carriage comes into the city. So you were protected passively just by virtue of being in there. That only works for the first six cities. But halalu ladas koldos shaladas inum koldos. But for the other cities, you have to come in and say, you know, like hareini muchon mezuman, I'm coming in to be protected by the city. You have all the kavana, and then it protects you. It's like a magical incantation almost. We'll talk about next week about other distinctions between the six original cities and the other ones. If you go to one of the six original ones, apparently they were more liberal on their fiscal policy, so you get to live there for free in public housing. But if you go to the other 42 Ari Miklat, then you actually have to pay rent as well. So there's some distinctions between the different Ari Miklat we'll talk about next time. But that brings us to our conclusion for today. Again, my apologies for, I thought it was 8:30, but then I realized it actually still said 8 o'clock on daily virtual. But God willing, next week it'll be 8:30. Yashar Koach everyone for all the messages and worrying and making sure that this took place. And looking forward to continuing to learn next week as well. Be'ezras Hashem Yisbarach. I'll stay on for any remaining questions, but the shiur has concluded. Good Shabbos to all. And
hope thank,
to
catch you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
I have a comment. The explanation that the there were three cities on the other side of the Yarden because there are more murders there. That is after the fact. The cities were established before the murders. I think they're established biblically. And so there has to be a better explanation than that.
Right. See, what you're asking, what you're saying is that it's anachronistic.
I was thinking that how far you have to travel to get to a city, so that's why the dispersion.
Right. But then the question is that should we really be investing the same amount of resources to where only 2.5 tribes reside as opposed to where the other, 10 tribes reside?
Well, so, I'm thinking in terms of distance to travel to get to a city, not the number of people that are going to go to a city.
Right. So it's not about you saying that, look, we have enough cities that could host enough, how common are people accidentally killing each other? We have enough cities. We just need to make sure that a person doesn't need to travel an entire country to get to one of them.
That's what I'm saying.
Honestly, that probably was the idea. And maybe this is a post facto justification of saying Hashem in his infinite wisdom understood that these would be future developments. And so that was part of God's plan from the get-go. I think that might be what the rabbis are getting to. But I see what you're saying. They only started being murderers within the Jewish community once the Jewish community actually settled. So how could we know about that beforehand? It's a little bit of an odd elucidation. I agree. Okay, Shkoach, any other remaining questions? Jenny?
I have another question. I'm not even really sure what the question is, but it's more of an observation that has me confused. So all these cities of refuge, right, are when someone is an accidental murderer, which totally makes sense from the point of view of the accidental murderer. If they are present when the person around them dies and they know they're going to be accused. But there are times when people don't know they are going to be accused of accidental murder. So how would they know to flee to the city of refuge before their avengers come for them?
Right.
Like, that's kind of a question that I have, like how the system works in practice. And also, like, if you are an avenger and you go into a city of refuge and you are successful at killing someone, does like the avenger then, I guess he gets also like tribe or she. Also, sometimes it's probably not clear whether someone is an accidental or an intentional murderer. So if you are accused of intentionally murdering someone, do you get to flee to the city of refuge because you're planning on putting up the defense that you are a non-intentional murderer?
So that I think that
those are my three questions.
So yeah, I'm glad you're bringing up those ideas for, and we definitely want to make sure those are clear. So the Mishnah says, regardless of the outcome, we basically, I'm trying to think of the modern day analogy, but I mean, when you think about it, I mean, someone who's put on a murder trial many times will keep him incarcerated until he's ready to go to trial. So, you know, this isn't incarceration. The city of refuge is much more hospitable than a jail cell in Rikers Island. But that is the
idea. So, like, you go to the city of refuge and you're like, I don't know what I'm going to be tried for. Might be intentional murder, might be unintentional. And the city of refuge guards are like, well, it's going to be one of them, so I guess you can stay here. They're not going to, like, turn someone away. They're like, yeah, we think this was intentional.
I don't think so, and I think that's part of the idea of why it's given to the Levium to it's a Levite city, because presumably the Levium are, you know, ministers, and they're supposed to be more of the, you know, I guess they were the rabbis back then, and rabbis technically are supposed to be pastoral and kind people in general. That's what we all hope to be. So Levium are saying, oh, you know, welcome in. We'll take care of you. We'll help you during this difficult time. That's always how I imagined it. But you're right. There's certainly, even though we're starting to get more of a flavor for an understanding of the details, it certainly leaves us with more questions for how precisely we parse these things out. Okay, so thank you for raising those points, Jenny. Zadie, very good question as well. That was bothering. I realized now that it was bothering me when I read it, but I kind of just ignored it. So I appreciate bringing that to the fore. I want to wish everyone a good Shabbos, and God willing, looking forward to seeing all of you in person very soon.
Thank you.
All right. Good night, Zadie. Good night, Jenny. Good night, Marina, Ruth, and Melissa, and Phyllis.
Elito.